Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Months ago, Iraqis and others working to build democracy pointed to a town south of Baghdad called Al-Hilla as one of their success stories. It was home to new schools, an Iraqi women's rights center, and a police academy. This morning, it's in the news again as the site of the latest car bombing. Reports say this bomb exploded at a graduation ceremony for the police academy, killing at least 13 people and injuring dozens more. The latest attack in this month leading up to the elections in Iraq is once again raising questions about the legitimacy of a vote in a country where no one feels safe. Today on the program, we'll talk with a reporter who's been based in Baghdad for the past year and a half. Alyssa Rubin heads the Baghdad Bureau for the Los Angeles Times. We'll be talking with her about the people she's met, the ideas they hold dear, and what's ahead for Iraq. And we invite you to join us. Do you see a democracy or a civil war in that country's future? Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Alyssa Rubin is joining us from the studios of KUSC in Los Angeles. Alyssa, it's good of you to spend an hour with us. Thanks.
Thank you.
You know, we hear so much about the number of people killed in each day's bombing, so much about the results, if you will, of the insurgency, and so little about what causes it. I'm curious to know, from your perspective, how easy is it to get at the story, to talk to the people about why it is they might choose to, you know, get their son involved in fighting the Americans? Is that a story that's easy to get at?
Well, on many counts, it's a very difficult story. It's certainly very difficult to speak to the insurgents for reporters without endangering themselves or their translators or staff. So in many ways, one of the great holes in journalism, with a few notable exceptions, is our ability to get the voices of sort of the opposition into the news. A few people speak to insurgents, a few reporters have and been able to get the occasional voice, but it's generally not a very reflective conversation because of the circumstances. Also, the insurgency is highly fractured, so that presents difficulties as well. However, by talking to disgruntled Iraqis, you can get a pretty good idea about what motivates people to want to join the insurgency, or perhaps to drift into it more than it being any conscious decision. What we saw in Fallujah much of the time was people who were not necessarily actively insurgents, but who were willing to allow them into their homes or fed them or perhaps transported them from one place to another. Sometimes they may have done that under duress, but other times they did it voluntarily as in a way, some small way to take up arms against the people, the Americans, who were taking up arms against their city. So it's a very fluid and somewhat gray situation. In that way, it's, I think, fairly classic of a guerrilla war where there are not really front lines or clear decisions, but a sort of continuum.
We were trying just a little bit earlier at the beginning of the program to get a line through to Baghdad to get caught up on the latest news there, and we've done that just now. So, Alyssa, stand by for half a sec while we talk with Dan Murphy for a moment. Dan is a correspondent with the Christian Science Monitor. Good morning, Dan.
Good morning.
Tell me, if you can, the latest news of this car bomb in Al-Hilla. We were getting some mixed reports about the number of people killed, the number injured.
I think it's pretty solid that we've had 20 people killed there. Maybe it's going to go down. I've seen some stuff that says it's as few as 9 or at least 9. But, clearly this is another major suicide car bombing on, a police post. And we've seen a lot of these in the past week or two.
I was going to ask you about that. Three of them on Monday that caused death. The assassination of Baghdad's governor yesterday. 5 Americans killed yesterday. How do you look at the sort of cumulative effect of this in terms of is this an escalation or is this just a continuation of a level of violence designed to completely screw up the vote at the end of the month?
Well, you see, the problem is if we speak of it as designed to completely screw up the vote at the end of the month, then it presupposes that you have the vote and it stops. And I don't think that that is necessarily the case, but I think clearly things have escalated. We are seeing major incidents, you know, for the past couple of weeks, almost every day. We have the highest ranking assassination of an Iraqi interim official since May, just yesterday. And we've had, you know, a number of attacks with horrific numbers of casualties just in the past few days alone. The Iraqi police and the Iraqi guards are taking a beating right now.
And any indication that the attacks are in any way focusing more specifically on people who are involved with that vote, people who might be setting up the polls or election officials?
Well, there have been, as you know, election officials, you know, dragged out of their cars and murdered in broad daylight here in Baghdad. And the police and the guards are going to be the front line in securing these votes. So, you know, this vote. So certainly by going after them, you're going after people involved in the election. Other people, who are involved in getting people's registration information out to them, which is being done through the country's subsidized food network. Many of these folks have received death threats that have sort of stopped participating in the process. And voters have seen, or at least some have seen, these statements from the more extreme insurgents sort of implying that anybody who votes is an infidel and could be liable to attack. And so large numbers of Iraqis who might like to vote are afraid about voting and say they won't on that basis.
Dan, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Dan Murphy, a correspondent with the Christian Science Monitor. And back to the guest who's going to be with us for the hour, Alyssa Rubin, bureau chief for the L.A. Times in Baghdad. Alyssa, you've been out of the country for just a short period of time. You listened to Dan's description of what's going on. Does it sound to you like more of the same? Does it sound to you like the story's changing?
Well, I do think it's going to be and has already become a very violent period leading up to the elections, but Dan's point is accurate. It's not clear when the violence stops. It seems very doubtful it would stop the day after the elections. So it's right. it is on the one hand part of an ongoing pattern of violence, but it's been every single day. Usually, what we've seen is a suicide bombing, an assassination. Then sometimes you might have a day or two without anything. Than another event. That's in the more heated periods generally. Now we're seeing really, really violence every day. There have been a few other periods like that, but clearly there's a sense that at the very least the insurgents want to make it clear that there's a heavy price to be paid, I think, for going ahead with the election, which many people or certainly a number of Sunnis, but also some others, have felt is ill-advised at this time.
I want to go back, if I can, to a story that you filed in the middle of November that quoted a couple of mothers who had children, boys, sons, in the thick of this. There was the woman, I believe, from Fallujah called Miriam, who had children involved in the insurgency. She didn't seem in any way bashful about talking to you about why it was important to her to have her boys picking up arms and fighting against the Americans.
Well, I think that's right, although she was careful to always be a little bit vague about how much they did. But for her, after all, she had to flee her home. She's a native Fallujan. The families lived there for generations. And suddenly outsiders come and tell them Americans and are telling them, you know, where they can go, where they can't go. There are all kinds of checkpoints. It was viewed as an enormous intrusion. Now, it is also true that there were people in Fallujah who felt quite battered and terrorized by the insurgents as well and felt they didn't have any choice but to open their doors. But that was not true of everyone. And I think she was one of those who felt a great pride and sense of independence in her city, and so did her family. And their identity is very tied up with their city. So when that's taken away or they feel almost humiliated by the fact that they can't stand up directly to the American presence, it becomes almost a point of honor to do something to strike back.
Do you find that the women are a major part of encouraging the men, the young men, their sons, to take part in the insurgency? I ask the question, Alyssa, because if we base what we know of Iraq on what we see on television, we never see the women. It's only the young men, you know, often, you know, disguised or you know, with their heads covered.
Right. Well, as is, I think, often the case in traditional societies, women do play a very important role, but their role is never a public one. And that's particularly true in places like Fallujah, which are very religious and quite conservative. I certainly sought out those women and went to some lengths to find people who were willing and to talk to me, and it took going several times in order for them to feel comfortable enough to begin to be a little more open. But I do think women certainly provide the support, and I imagine, as would be the case when a son in America comes home and announces he's joining the military or comes home and says, you know, our unit's being sent to Iraq, that mothers are a mixture of fearful and proud. I mean, the women I talked to were very afraid for their children, but they were also very proud of them. And I think that probably helps gives insurgents or would-be insurgents some of the moral support they need to go ahead and do something that in many ways is very likely to come out badly with at the least injury and at the worst death. But I do think women play a role, and it as I said, I don't think it's in the public sphere, but it is it's in that important private sphere that sort of creates a culture.
Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Alyssa Rubin is our guest this hour. She is bureau chief for the LA Times, based in Baghdad, has been there for the past year and a half. And a chance for us to hear how the stories of everyday life in Iraq will give us a clearer understanding of exactly what's going on in that country now. We'd like to have you join us at 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. You're listening to The Connection. My name is Dick Gordon. With me on the program this hour, Alyssa Rubin. She's had a fair amount of experience covering war zones, places like Afghanistan, Kosovo, also work in Pakistan. She's currently based in Baghdad, where she is one of the bureau chiefs there for the Los Angeles Times. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. We're going to take our first call from Canton, New York. Michael's joining us. Hi, Michael.
Hi.
Thanks for calling.
I just want to say a couple of things, and then I'll take my answer off the air. I have one question. I view these people as having been invaded and occupied by the most powerful nation in the world, of course. That's what we are. So were we, by the way, during the American Revolution. They came to our farms. They killed our children, our old and our young, fairly indiscriminately. Their combative dead are referred to as insurgents, mm-hmm. radicals, militants, terrorists even. Their civilian dead are referred to as collateral damage more often than not. We don't even have accurate numbers on how many civilian dead there are among the collaterals, that is. We were referred to as insurgents, radicals, militants, during the Revolutionary War. Why does no one refer to these people who are fighting in their countries, in their streets they were born on, in the houses often they've lived in as children? That's what they seem to be to me. And that is patriots. And I'll take that answer off the air.
Michael, don't disappear. Just stay with us for a minute. I'm going to ask Alyssa to answer. Alyssa, maybe if I can, by having you speak a bit about the other woman in that story in mid-November, because she's a mother, if I recall correctly, Atra, who had her son join the Iraqi National Guard, in effect working side by side with the Americans.
That's right. And, I mean, obviously they feel that... her husband felt that her son was a patriot and trying to create an environment of order that would for an independent Iraq, and that was also true of a story I did on some rice farmers south of Baghdad who had many of their children were killed in an ambush. They were all. Just joined, were new recruits to the Iraqi National Guard, so certainly there's a lot of different views about what it means to be a patriot. But I think the question that's very difficult is whether you're still a patriot when you are killing patently innocent civilians who are your own countrymen. When you're killing Americans, it's obviously a much more complicated situation in that, you know, the Americans, exactly, they are occupiers, they were invaders, and there's a good reason that people, lots of different people, might want them to go away. it's a considerably murkier situation when you're killing innocent members of your own country.
What do you think, Michael?
Well, I think that those people view the people who are becoming part of the armed forces, and I agree with her, first of all, that, of course, they are killing their countrymen, and it's unfortunate, but by no means in the same numbers that we've killed Iraqi civilians and insurgents. Some estimates are in the range of 100,000. I'm just throwing that number out there. Could be wrong. Don't know. I know there are an awful lot that are dead, and we don't talk about them. What I do know is that those people that are killing all those people feel like they're working for the invading army. They're working in the interests of the people who've invaded their country and killed so many of their mothers and daughters and brothers and fathers and grandfathers. They construe them to be spies. And until that vision has changed in some way, until it's fundamentally altered, I would suggest, and I'm just a civilian here in the United States, but mainly a good move would be for us to get the heck out of that country. That's my spin on it. I think they don't trust them. I think they construe them to be the lackeys of the American army, just as the British construe, I'm forgetting his name now, but their prime minister to be the lackey of George Bush.
Michael, I want to return to an example that Alyssa was talking about. This is a piece that she filed about the 10 rice farmers who had all sent their children, their sons off to join the Iraqi National Guard. They were all taken off to a distant place and tortured and killed. What you do with that story, Alyssa, is try to get at the fact that it's never quite as simple as it appears. That story has in it tribe, it has in it clan, it has in it, you know, religions, Sunni, Shiite. I just wonder in your own effort to try and make sense of what's going on, do we fail in trying to simplify it, saying it's either pro-American or anti-American, it's either Sunni versus Shiite? Is it increasingly complex?
Well, my guess is that it was complex from the beginning, but that those of us who cover it are increasingly aware of the many levels of complexity. I think now we would always ask, you know, what not only what sect people are, and to some extent that was done from the beginning, but also you try to have a sense of the how religious the people are that you're interviewing, what their political persuasion might be. For instance, those rice farmers who are in a very very religious Shiite area, they're right near Najaf, the most holy city for Shiites, I fully expected would be supporting the religious Shiite list of candidates, and I was quite surprised to find out that they were planning to support in the election Prime Minister Iyad Alawi, who is secular and could hardly be identified as a Shia, which told me that I had kind of misestimated or misunderstood the different motivations that might be at play.
What was their explanation for that? Were they able to sort of make sense of that?
Yes, their explanation was that he was trying to put the country back in order, and he hadn't had enough time to do that, and they wanted to give him a bit more time, and he seemed strong. And that is something you hear, that actually that idea about strength is very common among Sunnis and Shias. People are sort of looking for someone with the sort of clear authority that Saddam Hussein had, but somehow without the sort of more horrible and sort of worrisome and abusive, corrupt sides and tendencies and friends and cronies. Mm-hmm. And they are hopeful that Alawi will bring some of that. But in any case, that was really quite interesting because Alawi is also identified as being a former member of the Ba'ath Party and having a lot of Ba'athists around him. So I was rather struck that these farmers were so supportive of him. Whether they'll ultimately vote for him on election day, I don't know, but it certainly is a complex situation, and certainly tribes, particularly in rural areas, play a very large role in which side people end up on, and it's very difficult to separate these different pieces. And
does it mean that people in a village, people of a certain tribe, are all going to vote the same slate of candidates, and does that mean it's a less democratic vote?
Well, I actually don't think we know how people will vote. And certainly if people go to a mosque and the imam recommends or indicates, I don't think they'll come out and directly recommend one or another slate, but indicates favoritism towards or uses euphemisms to sort of push people in one direction or another, most people might vote that way. But my guess is not everybody. Now, I don't think that that in particular will be what makes the elections results questionable. You know, democracy evolves slowly. You're dealing with a society that large numbers of people who cannot read, who won't know what advertisements say. Maybe they'll see something on television. If they're in a rural area, they may not have much access to television. So it's not going to be a campaign with the kind of information and exposure of candidates that we're used to in the West, or even anything really close to that.
Connection listeners, do you see democracy? Do you see continued civil war in Iraq's future? Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. My guest this hour, Alyssa Rubin, she is bureau chief for the Los Angeles Times in Baghdad, has been there now for a year and a half, has got a couple of weeks here in the United States, is joining us from a studio in Los Angeles. We're going to Cambridge for our next call. Sam's joining us. Hi, Sam.
Hi. Not to complicate matters more, but I heard two stories yesterday about the foreign insurgents, so specifically that there were people sent in from Iran to participate, to vote, and that there's a lot of Baathist money coming out of Syria. And I was wondering if she could just discuss the interaction of those elements with the indigenous people that she was just describing. And I'll take it off the air.
Thanks, Sam. Alyssa, go ahead.
Well, I think that it's a very interesting question. Is how much will the neighbors be involved directly or indirectly in the election? And they are playing roles that are quite varied. There are different interests at play, obviously, for Iran, Syria, Saudi Arabia. One thing we're seeing, certainly foreign insurgents have come into the country. The numbers are very small compared to the Iraqi insurgents, but nonetheless they play a significant role. And that we're seeing that continuing. And at the same time, there have been allegations of Iranians coming across the border to vote, although I don't think they're going to be huge numbers of that. It's not so easy to qualify to vote. And it may be possible there'll be some sites where there's significant fraud and people are agree to let people who are not Iraqis vote. But it's hard to imagine that would have a huge impact, because already you have a majority Shiite country, so that constituency will have quite a loud voice. Syria, it's a little there. I think we're seeing more of the insurgents crossing than a problem of sort of trying to influence the vote directly. It's certainly believed that all the countries are feeding money into the political parties, or particularly Iran, quite possibly Shia groups in Syria may be doing that as well. It's a bit unclear what Saudi Arabia is doing, but all of these countries have a stake in how things come out. And even if they can't influence the outcome in any decisive way, they want to sort of have shown that they are in there, so that when Iraqis are elected, or those who gain power outside the electoral process through the insurgency, have to pay attention to them, so that the interests of neighboring countries are not entirely neglected.
Let's take our next question from Lynn, Massachusetts. Karen's joining us on the line from there. Hi, Karen.
Hi.
What are you thinking?
Well, I was listening to one of the previous calls who was suggesting that we leave, and it sort of actually follows up on the last one, asking about the neighbors. And I was wondering what would happen if we did, you know, people, I mean, obviously we do want to try to leave as soon as we possibly can. But I think that one of the things that we forget about is what happened, like, as in Vietnam, when we left over there, there was a huge, the worst atrocities happened because of the vacuum that we created by our leaving. And I was wondering, you know, what possible scenarios could possibly happen if we did leave? I mean, would the neighbors step in, or how exposed would our supporters be without us there?
What do you think, Alyssa?
Well, it's always difficult to know exactly what would happen. But I think if we left altogether, there's broad agreement that there would be carnage and mayhem. The Iraqi security forces are certainly completely unprepared, as we can see, to take over, to protect themselves, to protect civilians. They're just not there yet. They don't have the equipment. Insurgents would quite rapidly become very powerful. Now, I don't think that's a likely scenario. It seems very remote that the U.S. would pull out altogether. What exactly will happen after the elections as the Iraqis begin to establish a government, how visible and involved U.S. soldiers will be is an interesting question. It's hard to know. Everyone has said, no, they'll be there. They'll sort of be there as long as the new Iraqi government wants them there. And that will present a real dilemma for the new Iraqi government because everybody's favorite line is they want the occupation to end, but it's going to end by soldiers leaving, and at least for the time being, and probably for at least a couple or three or four, or maybe even 5 years in the future, the Iraqi military and police and Iraqi National Guard are really not ready to take over. So exactly how they're going to try to finesse that is quite unclear.
Alyssa, is that if the election goes ahead, as everybody says it will, and if the Sunnis don't take part, as they have said that they will not, and if that means that they are then not represented in the government, they're not part of the decision-making process, they're not part of approving the new constitution for the country, I mean, the dark side is that's the recipe for a civil war. How could it be otherwise?
Well, I think that's true. It's certainly the recipe for civil strife. A civil war would be very broad in a country that's already quite divided. I mean, clearly there are large areas in the south and in Kurdistan as well that are really quite peaceful. I mean, as you've noticed the last few days with violence, the violence is really concentrated in quite a small area. The area around Baghdad, maybe as far south as Hilla, which is, you know, just an hour south of Baghdad, up to Mosul. It's a pretty confined or it's a very specific area of the country. But it is true that if there is no way found for Sunnis to be represented, it's a very serious matter. And one of the first tests of whatever government is elected, which will undoubtedly, even if Sunnis did participate, would be majority Shia and Kurd, is how much they reach out to Sunnis, how much they attempt to share power, what they do next, because it will be a very illegitimate-looking election if Sunnis entirely sit out. I tend to think they won't entirely sit out. There are secular Sunnis. There are Sunnis who've worked with the government. There are even some former Baathists, like those around Interim Prime Minister Alawi, who are likely to be participating. But if they largely either can't vote or don't, then that will really undermine the election. So the test for the new government will be, okay, how can they compensate for that? How much power are they willing to give up in order to have a government that is a little bit stronger? It's not going to be terribly strong, but that has a little more credibility in the country. And will it be seen that way, or will it be seen as sort of noblesse oblige and they're giving three ministries to them because they just want to have a Sunni face?
And regardless of who votes and who runs, is it still going to be seen as a more Iraqi government than what's in place right now?
I think that it will be, yes. I mean, this is an election, really being held by Iraqis, and Iraqis are voting, and Americans have not... I don't think I've been entirely comfortable with some of the groups that have emerged and emerged with considerable strength. I mean, they may say nice things publicly, but I think there's some unease about the very, very large strength of the Shia religious factions.
I got to stop you there. We're going to take a very short break. We'll be back with more from Alyssa Rubin, bureau chief for the LA Times in Baghdad. We'd like to hear from you at 1-800-423-8255. Those stories of everyday life in Iraq, how they illuminate what's going on in that country for you. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection. My guest is Alyssa Rubin. She's bureau chief for the LA Times in Baghdad. Over the past year and a half, when she has been able to get away from stories of car bombs and assassinations and the insurgency, has spent time with Iraqi people trying to figure out how they see the situation. She's with us this hour and ready to talk further about the way that she sees people trying to make it through their lives in Baghdad and also in Iraq. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. We're going to take our next call from Methuen, Massachusetts, and Joanne's with us. Methuen, sorry, Joanne. Joanne, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Hi, go ahead.
I'm sorry. Every day when I hear the news, my heart goes out to these people. Can you draw me a picture of life under Saddam and life now for the ordinary Iraqi as to and address levels of employment, level of education, number of students, availability of health care, anything that would relate to one's everyday life?
Well, that's a very, very good question. I have to say myself and my colleagues in Baghdad, many of us were not there under reporting when Saddam was there. There are some reporters who have been, but it's a bit of perspective that many of us at least lack to some degree.
Why don't you pick it up from when you got there, Alyssa?
Well,
talk about the way that you've seen their lives change just in the last year and a half.
Sure. What I was going to say is the one thing that there's very broad agreement about, and I've talked to lots of correspondents who have been there, is that it is a very disorderly place now. And even something as simple as just, you know, there are piles of garbage on the street, there's public utilities, particularly in Baghdad, one's very aware of this. You've heard a million times, the electricity is not on a lot of the day. Water is a problem. That's all true. Now, there were other areas of the country which did not have those resources under Saddam, and Baghdad did. But nonetheless, that's a significant one because Baghdad is the urban center. It's the center of government. There are many universities there. That's a huge setback. And so I think in terms of daily life, the sort of basics that you need. I mean, it's difficult to study at night if you don't have electric light. It's difficult to to sort of get your cooking done so that you can also go to school or go to work if you have to haul your water upstairs in pails instead of being able to turn on the tap. These are not small matters, although they're rather tedious to when you sort of try to describe them. So I do think that there's a lot in the sort of public services arena that in a large urban city like Baghdad has deteriorated.
Will a woman go out to the market on a given day and be able to buy fresh vegetables? If a child needs to go see a doctor, can the mother or father take that child to a clinic? Yeah,
there's certainly. I mean, there is no food shortage in Iraq. There is plenty of food. I mean, what exactly people eat, an individual family's circumstances may have changed. They may have less meat or be having to eat more rice. But there are still these ration baskets that people get every month with rice and oil and other basics of life, and they got that under Saddam as well. Yes, you can go out to a doctor. There are certainly many doctors. I've been ill in Iraq and gone to doctors. And you see lots of people doing that, and you can go into a hospital. That is available. But supplies in many hospitals were terribly decimated by the looting, and it has taken quite a bit of time to rebuild. Now, some of them just recently have begun. I was just speaking to some Iraqi doctors a couple of weeks ago, and they are feeling like they have more on hand now than they did, say 6 months ago. But that's a long period in which when it's a hospital you're talking about, they don't have sufficient supplies on hand, or they don't have the right drugs, or they don't have beds that are clean or whatever it is. And so that is something that seems to have deteriorated since Saddam Hussein was in power.
1-800-423-8255 is the number to join us. We're going to take our next call from Alan, who's on the line from Fairfield, Iowa. Hi, Alan. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I apologize if this has been asked already. I joined the show late. My question is directed towards the press in general, and that is, it's curious why the word insurgency is used, and it has been used from day one by the press, when the definition of insurgency means one or a rebel group that rises up against an established government.
Or established authority.
When we were the invading army.
Right.
And it inherent in that use is tacit consent to some extent to say that we were the established authority when in fact we weren't. We invaded Iraq. And so I'd just like to hear a response.
Well, you know, we've really agonized over what to call the people who are fighting, whether it was initially primarily the Americans, now it's the Iraqi government, which were seen often as agents of the Americans. And it has been very difficult to find a word that people agree on. There are many people who would criticize the use of the word resistance, which was a term used by Iraqis often, because that seemed to some people to give too positive an image. Rebels is something we use sometimes, but obviously, your critique has makes sense to me. It's very difficult to find a word for it, and increasingly difficult as the Iraqi government does become somewhat more established and has some credibility among the people. Ministries are operating. These are ministries that have been around, after all, since the old Iraqi government and are employing, once again, the same Iraqis they did under the old government. So if they're being bombed, are they being bombed by rebels? Are they being bombed by insurgents? Are they being bombed by resistance? It is really difficult to find terminology that does justice to the complexity.
Earlier in the program, Alan, we had a caller who thought that patriots was a more appropriate word for the people who are fighting against the Americans, even though there are Iraqis who choose to fight with the Americans, so it kind of gets complicated. Is there a word that you think better matches the people who are using car bombs, the people who are attacking specifically the American forces?
Well, as the war has gone on, obviously the view of the word has changed, but it was used from day one when we entered Baghdad, and basically the war was declared won at that point. And early at that stage, even as that was taking place, the word was used by the press. And so at that point, I guess in my opinion, many of these people were defenders. They were defending their country mm-hmm. against a foreign invasion. And
I have to tell you, though, in that month after the American army got to Baghdad, which was a time that I spent there, there was in that city, and I don't speak for the country, a sense of, okay, Saddam Hussein is gone. That's not a bad thing. The Americans are here. Let's see what they're going to do. There was even among Iraqis, and you'll recall that the car bombing and these kinds of attacks didn't start in any kind of organized fashion for some months. So at that point that you're describing, Alan, there were people who, I would say almost a majority, thought, okay, they're an occupying force. We might not like them, but let's see what they're going to do.
All right. Well, I appreciate the response from your guest and from you. It's always been a curiosity to me because I think it's obvious. I was one of many who disagreed with the invasion of Iraq.
Right.
And I felt that the press's characterization early on, to some extent, gave tacit consent to the invasion of Iraq.
No, I think that's quite a legitimate criticism. I don't know, Alyssa. What do you think?
Well, I do think that that's true. There was some tacit consent, but I also think there was a lot of genuine and legitimate confusion and concern about what exactly to call the insurgency as it first, and there I'm using the word, when it first emerged. And it was believed to be, particularly at the beginning, former Baathists, former members of Saddam Hussein's military, who were people who the U.S. had been fighting. So were they still the enemy, or it was just very murky, and language is terribly important, but often very difficult to find a single word that conveys sort of all the different political elements and concerns that you're trying to use. So I would agree that it's that perhaps insurgents does lose some of the full meaning of who these people are, but that it's not easy to figure out what the right word is.
Let's go to Norton, Massachusetts for our next call. Bob's joining us. Hi, Bob.
Good morning.
Thanks for calling. What are you thinking?
I'd like to ask the guest whether she or any of her brave colleagues have attempted or, in fact, become embedded with the insurgencies. And I say insurgencies, and I'm sure she'll understand that that term. And whether her readers will need a more human perspective on the role of the insurgent and what their human side of this conflict is. And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Bob.
Sure. Well, certainly myself and my co-bureau chief talked a lot about whether we could embed with insurgents, but really decided it was way too dangerous for us to put anyone at that kind of risk. At the time, for instance, of Fallujah, there was quite a bit of interest in having someone embedded with the insurgents. We had someone embedded with the U.S. Marines. Why not with the insurgents and get the other side? But we also felt a commitment both to our Iraqi staff and to our Western staff that you don't want to send people into a certain something that could be almost certain death from the Americans and possibly and the risk that your hosts might turn on you. Now, they might not. There were people who did do some embedding with the insurgents, some French journalists. It was not impossible to do. And I don't – I certainly remain and I think all of us, certainly at the LA Times, were concerned about not having those voices. And we absolutely need to have those voices. One of the most difficult aspects of this of dealing with the rebels or the insurgents and writing about them is that they haven't articulated yet a political program or what exactly they want. And usually when you are covering a guerrilla war, you can go and find, or even competing warlords, you go to one and then you go to the other and you ask, what do you want or what's the main bones of contention? And people present their views and then those can be presented. And it adds quite a large measure of credibility to the two sides and particularly in this case it would to the insurgents, but they have not done that yet. It has been sort of purely aimed at disruption and of Iraqi sort of the new Iraqi institutions and obviously to some extent the Americans. And so it's I don't think we've done justice to the human story. It has been very difficult to do without putting lives at risk.
Yeah, and yours included. I mean, you're skipping over the part where, you know, journalists were being kidnapped and being held and being beheaded. I don't know if you've ever had an experience like that while you've been working there.
Well, I've not been kidnapped or even come close to that. And you know, basically, I'm very grateful because I think it has a. You don't realize what a large effect that can have on how you think about the story, no matter how hard you try to not have it have an effect. But there are enormous risks for journalists, and even something as seemingly safe as going to talk to the mothers of people who were in the Fallujah resistance. You don't know when someone else from their family is going to show up and not want you to be talking to them and what they might do. You just don't know. It might be fine.
Has that happened? Have you had a gun pulled on you while you're there?
Yes, I have, but not talking to women in a hospital in Fallujah.
I guess I wonder, Alyssa, if you can work there without being scared every time you leave the LA Times home or hotel or wherever you work from.
Well, I think you, nowadays, I mean, since the kidnappings really began in earnest in September and October, I would guess that most people feel a certain nervousness when they go out. It would be foolish not to. But if you, I certainly go out almost every day, and usually for several hours at a time. You know, if I thought about it all the time, I'd never go out. And so you feel a little concerned, sort of like as you might if you were going on a hike and you could see that it looked like there was going to be a very bad thunderstorm. You think, well, you know, do I really want to be up on that mountain when there's lightning? And I think there's a bit of that feeling when you go out to report in Iraq as well. And we go to quite considerable lengths to not take certain roads. There's a lot of reporting we decide not to do because it's too risky, not just for us, but for the Iraqis who are bravely working with us. And we have to take into account many lives when we go on assignment.
You'll be back there in about 2 weeks. Are you in any way looking forward to getting back on this story?
Oh, I'm very much looking forward to getting back, yes. I've missed it. I always worry that there's a kind of narrative to a story like this, and you do lose it a bit when you go away. You also gain perspective, so there's merit to having some distance. But it's a very important time. It's very complicated. I don't know how it's going to come out. I don't know what the different candidate lists who are likely to win power, if assuming the elections are held. I don't know what they're going to do, and it'll be very interesting to see.
Well, we benefit from having you and others there. I want to thank you for spending some time. When you go back, please take care, will you?
I will.
Alyssa Rubin is a correspondent, co-bureau chief for the LA Times, based in Baghdad. Earlier in the program, we talked with Dan Murphy, correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor, also speaking to us from Baghdad. The Connections produced by Jennifer Ehrlich, Catherine Fenollosa, Jen Mattson, Virginia Prescott, Christina Russo, and Doug Sugars. Tara Murphy is our senior producer. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.